Hi, welcome back and happy new year. This is Tanya, also known as Cypher of Tear. And this is actually our first recording of 2016 because we had a whole lot of tech fail last week and then I went out of town. So welcome to 2016 on Fresh Out of Tokens. And I will stop hogging the mic so David can get in his New Year's greeting.
Hello. It's 2016. That's interesting.
Yes.
Also, this episode will come out within like a week of us recording it. That's new.
Yes, we actually finished our backlog with last week's episode. So this is a novel thing to actually not have like a month's worth of episodes in the can. And you have some news from early in this year, don't you, David? A certain life event that happened?
Well, I did get engaged, yes.
Yes, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And we are very lucky to have as our first guest of the new year, Sydney Fussell, also known as SangFroidSan on Twitter, if you want to say hi, Sydney.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, most welcome. I'm very glad you're here. So yeah. Let me get our usual intro business out of the way so we can get right into all of our great questions. For those that remember from our last few episodes, or if you've never heard the show before, we are part of the Geek.fm network, along with Geeks in Sneaks, Chromatic Life, and More Than Bits podcasts. We have teas and other items in the I Need Diverse Games Spreadshirt shop, and we split the profits 50-50 with our friend Chachi Bopings, who designed our logo and header. There's also a blog to complement the show, which is at outoftokenscast.wordpress.com. If you have questions, compliments, hate mail, or want to be on the show eventually, send us a note at freshoutoftokens@gmail.com. So with all of the usual, you know, admin stuff out of the way, let's hop into our usual rotation of questions, at least for the first few. And we actually got a lot of listener questions for you, Sydney.
Woohoo! I love talking.
So David, do you want to shake things up and you go first?
Sure.
Okay.
So Sydney, do you want to tell us a bit about, like, who you are and what you've done?
Sure. So I've turned a pretty serious drinking problem into a great little freelancing career. So that's lots of fun. But no, so, like, I've been doing freelance video game research for about 4 years now, maybe 4.5 years. Just because about 4 years ago, the conversation about race and video games was just not at all happening. And the past 4 years, I've seen it grow and get more complicated. I've seen a lot of people join in on it. You know, I think about, I haven't been following Tanya for at least a year-ish, something like that. So definitely that once Tanya got in and started doing I Need Diverse Games, the conversation on race and video games really, really just like was up to 11. It really exploded. So talk about me and sort of what I'm doing, you sort of also have to talk about Tanya and what a great job she's done with I Need Diverse Games and sort of getting that conversation about racing games into the mainstream, making the contacts, doing the hashtags. That's great. So yeah, I talk about race and video games, I do gender and stuff like that. I'm on the Twitters, which is lots of fun. Mostly I complain. I'd say that's probably my big thing.
Hey, it is what it is. Sometimes complaining is the only way to get people to pay attention.
I totally agree with that.
So, you know, you write a lot about racing games. So what got you into gaming specifically?
Well, for me, video games were sort of, when I was younger, video games were sort of like a way for me to sort of escape all of the sort of like racism that I saw in sort of the other fields. I was never really into sports. I was never really into hip hop. I was never into sort of like these things that were sort of seen as being black. So I was really into video games. And so as I got older, I started to realize, you know what? I think it's wrong that video games are sort of seen as being a not black thing, you know? And I started to sort of demand that it could be a black thing, that it could have black people in it, black men as well as black women, and it could represent us positively. And so by the time I made it to, I don't know, like early 20s in college, it sort of turned from, oh, there's like black things I do and there's video games, to sort of like putting them together and just feeling like, you know what, I put a lot of time and energy and love into this medium, and I think we should be well represented in it. And so that's where I started writing essays and being more critical about race in video games, and really started to meet with other people who, like me, really demanded that blackness in video games not be seen as these exclusive categories. You can have one and the other. Evan Narcisse wrote this great piece about black hair in video games called The Natural. He wrote it for Kotaku, and it's just a small thing, like how video game characters tend not to have black hair, but after playing video games for years and years and not seeing that represented, you want to feel valued some way. And the past couple years, I think we've slowly started to see a little bit more about that. Definitely we're louder, we're better organized, we've got hashtags, Tanya's running all over the world making sure someone's listening to us. So yeah, I like the progress I've seen recently. Definitely room for improvement though.
Cool. Yeah, I go and yell when I can. And Evan's piece is amazing. It is in State of Play, the full piece.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have a link to the Kotaku version in the show notes.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of... The thing about this is that it's important, I think, that there's just one or two people talking about racing games. There's, like, lots of people with lots of different opinions saying lots of different things. Whenever I talk to Tanya 101, one of the things we talk about is that we don't want to feel as though we can only talk about one thing at a time. So we can talk about race and games and gender and privilege. We can talk about all these different things as part of this larger conversation about race and games, which I think is one of the reasons why State of Play is, like, so kick-ass, if I may, is mm-hmm. because you can, like, really look take this conversation so many different ways.
Yeah, definitely.
Was that the book you made me read at IndieCade?
Yes, it was. No, we were at IndieCade, and I was like, read this right now.
You're like assigning homework. I love that. Yep, highly recommend it. Highly recommend it.
Yes.
Yeah, it was very good. So you've had a few pieces in Offworld. How did you wind up writing for them?
Well, I have to take it back to summer 2015. Tarek Musa wrote that amazing piece about The Witcher 3. He wrote it for Polygon, sort of about how he was saying Witcher 3 was a great game, it's extremely white, it excludes people of color, and the fan reaction was that it's okay to exclude people of color because of historical accuracy. And he wrote the Polygon piece, and there was this huge backlash to that, and I felt like I sort of had things to sort of join in on that conversation. So my response to the backlash that Torek was getting was written in Offworld. I mean, the Offworld editors, Lee Alexander and Laura Husband and Rob Echeza, they're great. They really let me say everything I wanted to say. I didn't feel hindered by anything, by any of their edits. They were really like, you know what, as long as you can back it up, say what you got to say. So that came out over the summer. And then a few months later, I did a piece about black men and black masculinity in video games. And so that came about because I wanted to write about black people in video games, but I felt like it was reductive just to assume that black men and black women have the same problems. They have different issues. So at first I wrote the piece about black men and black masculinity, and then a few weeks ago I wrote about black women in video games. And I made sure to interview just these great black women who are doing lots of stuff in the industry. Tanya was one of them, and actually she kicks off the piece with an F-bomb. So I made sure that, and so I made sure that she started that piece off just because there was this real belief that race in video games is this new sort of like fashionable trend that just started up a couple months ago. And Tanya and Lauren and Latoya and Sophia and all these women that I interviewed were like, we've been doing this for a long time and we're just now starting to get people listening to us. So Offworld's been a great experience. I highly recommend writing for them if you can pitch something to Lee or to Laura or something like that. But yeah, definitely they do longer pieces. And sometimes mm-hmm. Sometimes your arguments take time. I know that I'm not the biggest Twitter person. I'm much prefer to write via essays. But I think that if you've got an argument and you really need to let it breathe, you need some time and some space to let it breathe, I highly recommend going through Offworld just because they'll give you the time and the space and energy and the resources to really come up with a robust argument. And hopefully I'll get to write for them a little bit more, doing a couple more things that start off with Tanya cursing.
Well, you know, I'm always happy to give a soundbite.
A spirited response.
Oh, spirited. That's one way to put it.
Yeah.
But as we know, in depth, all three of us, that you can't kind of be on the internet without people being assholes, to be blunt.
True.
So, you know, instead of phrasing it the way I put in the notes with, have you had pushback? What kind of pushback have you had on your off-world pieces?
Well, so Twitter is just such a, it's such a thing, you know, like, it's so important, and it's a great way to connect with people, but I think that level of accessibility just can sort of be overwhelming, and there was this real belief by some people that when it came to specifically Black women in video games and how video game developers can help Black women, can, you know, boost them either as players or as creators or as critics, there was this real belief that these random Twitter people who weren't part of the conversation could just jump in and they could solve it. They knew exactly what to say and exactly what to do. And it's like, the first thing you need to do in this situation, just be very, very quiet. That's step one. Just be quiet and listen. And I think that Twitter is something that sort of like prioritizes jumping in and speaking first and sort of like being the loudest. And I know that Tanya and I, we were both sort of like, you know what, this is sort of a situation where we need people to just chill out, be quiet, listen. When I wrote the off-world piece, Lee was very specific. She said, this is something that I want to emphasize Black women's voices. And I think that Twitter is not conducive to listening to other people. I think Twitter can be great for sort of turning it into the Tonight Show and just you and your feelings and what you want to do. But that's not always helpful. That's not a helpful, productive thing. So the pushback I've gotten on my off-world articles has definitely been people who know nothing about race or video games for that matter, sort of jumping in and feeling as though they know exactly what to do. And they want to tell me this, this, and that. And all I can say is all the women I interviewed are badasses. They can handle themselves. And no kind of Twitter nonsense gets them down for more than a moment. So, Tanya especially.
Yeah, we had that moment of, oh my god, look at what this academic at my school is doing. And I'm like, nah, dude, I'm good.
Right, exactly. There's really this belief that, oh, I know exactly how to solve this problem of race in games. And it's just like, well, first of all, where have you been the past couple years? Would have been helpful. But then second of all, it's like, this is something that has to happen on multiple levels. I think with the off-world piece, I wanted to show that you need people, you need players criticizing the work, you need creators and people and developers of color joining the industry. You need player, it just has to happen on different levels all simultaneously. And the way that we get to that, where there are people of color engaging games from these different spaces all at the same time, is we need openness, we need a helpful environment, you know, they need resources. I'm a big fan of Issa Rae. Issa Rae is a writer who's sort of like developing these different projects for HBO, and they for the New York Times interviewed her and was like, you know, what do people of color need to survive as writers or producers? And her exact words were, just put us in the room. And I feel like that's exactly true for people of color in video games. It's not about needing super special resources or, you know, all this other stuff. Just put us in the room, listen to our ideas, and things will change. And I think that every step we can take towards that happening is very positive. So I'm always trying to get, you know, I'm always trying to get us into the room.
Okay.
Interesting.
I've always got, like, lots and lots of feels. I'm a feels person, so. And it's funny because Tanya was in New York not that long ago, and so she'd just be like, hi, how are you? And I'd be like, oh my gosh, this, 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 and this. And I've got to say this, 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 and this. So thanks for putting up with me.
That was totally cool.
You sort of touched on this. Is there anything else you'd like to see more of in terms of, like, game critique?
The answer to that question is money. I definitely wish there was more money in games criticism, because I think that would encourage more critique. And I think it also encourage people to sort of, like, work a little bit harder and sort of develop and let these ideas marinate. Everybody wants to do game criticism, and as someone who's done it for a couple years and has made a little bit of money doing it, I can say honestly, it's not so much about just getting out a piece every 3 days or just sort of throwing stuff against the wall constantly so that you can get freelance checks. You really want to move the conversation forward. You really want to be saying things that's worth listening to. And I know those seem really obvious, but we can all probably point to 4 or 5 people off the top of our heads where it's like, I've heard that several times before. You should probably say something new.
Yeah.
But I think that the environment right now, if you feel like you have something to say or something new to add in terms of like race and gender or sexuality or privilege, something like that, I definitely think now is the best time to try to be making that argument. There are more people listening for it than ever. There are more people within the industry than ever who are hungry for these viewpoints. And so I definitely think it's getting better and better to express those viewpoints. But that being said, just take some time to marinate your arguments, make sure they're good, try to link up with mentors, and just try to move the conversation forward. It's one of the things where it's like, it seems obvious, but just really make sure that you're well read and try to like take that next step. We don't want a whole bunch of like echo chamberness or repetition, because that's not helpful. I think that this is something where you can actually measure the impact. Like, you can actually look year by year at the number of people of color that are behind the scenes, that are on the forefront, that you can see the number of diverse games. So since you can actually measure this from time to time, I think you should really, really be very sincere in terms of like making sure you're trying to do something that's impactful and that can change the industry, because we see the effects every single year.
Very true. I mean, it's getting slightly better, but hey, it's moving at a glacial pace, and hopefully that will improve.
It is moving at a slow pace, but I mean, I hate to say we have to be patient. I actually think we probably have to be impatient. We need to constantly be pushing for, you know, let's not wait until the industry is ready for us. Let's go ahead and do this now, and then when they can catch up with us, instead of us trying to chase behind this industry and just say, oh, are you okay with us being here? Are you okay with us being here? No, go in there, make the change you need to be in the room, you know?
Yeah, I think we'd all die if we kind of waited on the industry to catch up. So, I mean, just like any kind of social change, if you sit around and wait on it to happen, you'll be there for a while. You'll be dust.
A long time. Mm-hmm, yeah.
As I've told more cynical friends of mine, if you don't do anything, then it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the attitude.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you believe you can succeed or not. If you don't do anything, you've already lost.
Exactly. And just, you know, to use my personal example, if Tariq Musa had decided not to write that first Witcher 3 article, I don't know that I would have written my Witcher 3 article. And so, like, when you write something that has impact, you inspire more people to also do things that have impact. So even if you feel as though, I don't know if people are really listening to me, I have something to say, but I don't know if it matters, go ahead and do it, because you will inspire more people to do more things. Like, Tariq inspired me. Then, like, I started writing the off-world pieces. And then one of the off-world pieces was about the different black women. And they started doing things. So there's, like, that cyclical effect. You know, we're helping each other out. Even if the industry won't, unfortunately, help us out as readily.
Right. Well, we touched on it a little bit in terms of, like, you know, what would help people get into games journalism. Obviously, more money, because, you know,
yes,
because right now, and I naively asked this on Twitter once, like, so can I make a living doing this? And everyone's like, haha, no. I was like, oh, well, then, I guess I'll take that and run with it.
What you can do is build contacts and get your name out there and start and get recognition from the industry. There are things you can do to sort of like help a little bit, but I would recommend having like a rich uncle or something, if you can help it. If you have the choice, have a rich family member. I'm just saying.
Yeah. I'll take and run with that. Sadly, I'm an only child, so there are no uncles to be found.
No.
Well, other than, you know, looking to be equally paid, do you have other tips for someone looking to go into games journalism or critique?
Definitely reach out to people. Don't feel as though you have to do it alone. Don't feel as though someone's too big to talk to. I mean, everyone has a Twitter, everyone has a Facebook, people have LinkedIn and all these different social media sites. Definitely take advantage of that. If there's someone out there that you think is just amazing, reach out to them, DM them, email them, you know, just say, hey, I like what you're doing. I'm a big fan of Austin Walker. He is brilliant. And I actually moved to New York just very recently, and he DM'd me about meeting up at a games event. And while I was there, I met other people. So just reach out, you know, just reach out. If you see someone who's just amazing or just really killing it, definitely reach out to them. It doesn't need to be someone who's bigger than you necessarily. So if you yourself, people listening to this, are an established journalist and you see someone who's sort of on the come up with not that many followers and you like their work, go ahead and signal boost them and reach out to them and say, hey, you know what? I like what you're doing. I think this is something that has to be done collectively. I don't think this is something that one person is going to just end racism in video games. I think it's something we have to do collectively. And the way you do that is reaching out and getting to know people. I know Tanya sort of does this thing where she gets in, is nice to everyone, makes contacts. And then after the second day, she's like, all right, you guys, going to chill out now.
I try.
Yeah. But definitely reach out to people. Definitely be social. Get used to names. If there's any names that you're seeing over and over again, definitely take note of that. Say, okay, this person, you know, has two pieces in Polygon. This person has two pieces in Kotaku. You know, this person gets retweeted a lot. Definitely just keep your eyes open and get to know people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Sydney, what is coming up for you? What's next?
What's next for me? I know this is probably a question later, but like the game I'm playing right now, Ogre Battle 64, it's a N64 game that came out 2000 from Atlus. It's this great strategy RPG. And I'm actually screen capping everything and I have lots and lots of commentary. Just a brief, because you know, RPGs, the stories start off normally get a little bit crazy. So briefly, Ogre Battle 64 is a game about a country, in revolution. There's a civil war happening, and then the civil war sort of turns into this sort of like magical, supernatural storyline. But there's so much great stuff happening in terms of like race and racial representation and gender and those kinds of things. So right now I'm screen capping that. I definitely plan on either doing some type of like live tweet, commentary, essay, blog. I don't know exactly what form it will take, but I mean, this is a game that came out in 2000, which I feel very confident saying is much more progressive in terms of representation of race, gender, and sexuality than any game that I've seen in the past couple of years. I mean, it leaves Witcher 3 in the dust in terms of, like, representing queer people, representing people of color, or sort of talking about things like slavery and class and oppression and stuff like that. So probably the next thing for me is just going to talk about why I'm just so madly in love with this game. This is probably the fifth time I've played it since I originally played it way back in 2000. So that's going to be my jumping off point to the next thing I do. I'm not sure if that'll be an essay or a slideshow. I don't know yet, but right now I'm just really enjoying the game.
Cool. So we actually have a link about this one article and like I can just hear the disgust in your voice, David.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
So why don't you talk about the article then? Since you sound very vocally unhappy with this.
It's the article where this woman does like blackface 13 times. Is that the one?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Apparently she was trying to like raise awareness or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
What I found really interesting about it though is that if you look at the original thing, there are three pictures. There's her in blackface, then the actual lady she's, like, copying.
Oh.
You could just take those pictures that she has acquired somehow, right?
Yeah. I've, seen the nonsense. It's, wow.
I mean, really, how else do you explain that, you know, and she's not American, but that still doesn't excuse it.
No. The something about the phrase raise awareness really turns people into assholes. I don't know what it is, but like people will do just hideous shit in the name of quote unquote raising awareness. The fact that it was pictures of her over and over again seems like she's mostly trying to raise awareness of herself. But I look at stuff like this and it's just like, no thanks. I would recommend, I mean, who do you run this by? Like, do you not have one person in your life that will sit you down and be like, what are you doing? Stop it.
Yeah.
I'm looking for the original thing because, yeah, she has, there are pictures of the original women that she could have just put together and had basically the same effect, but with less her in them.
And less racism. You know, 200% less racism, more awareness.
Yeah, exactly. Someone should have been like, you know what, it's great, you want to raise awareness, just try to maybe tone the racism down somewhere around 200%. That would be awesome.
The original post just says, update, since I have no intentions to offend anyone, and yet I'm not able to answer all of you, I've decided to delete my post.
For the best.
Good.
For the best.
That,
for the best.
Yeah. Well-meaning white people are going to be the death of me, I swear.
Okay, that's going to be the line that starts off my next essay. I'm stealing it. That's how it's happening.
There you go. And the other happening that's going on actually today as we record this podcast, it is year two of Oscar So White.
Mm-hmm.
So Creed was nominated, but not any of the people who are folks of color who actually played Creed, the title character.
Yep. Creed is about a black man, and the Oscar nominee goes to the white guy, of course.
Yeah.
That's also true for Straight Outta Compton, which was sort of like the origin story about N.W.A. The main Oscar nomination it got was for its screenplay, which is written by a white writing duo. So this is the only two movies literally about black people. The only Oscar nominees were the white people involved in them. So I think we sort of have a problem here, Academy. I don't know if you're listening, but this is sort of like an issue that's just happened 2 years in a row.
Yeah, and let's not forget that Idris Elba's film about being an African dictator totally got snubbed.
It totally did. Beast of No Nation is great. Like, it is, it's a very, very powerful film. Idris Elba is great in it. They filmed it on location. There's just so many great things about it. Totally overlooked. So that's disappointing. I saw The Revenant. I was not as impressed with The Revenant. That was sort of Leonardo DiCaprio's latest. God bless Leonardo DiCaprio. He needs to give it a rest. Like,
he really don't try.
Just take a couple years and just, you know, recollect himself, rest. Hateful Eight, which is a movie that director Quentin Tarantino has said is literally about race. The only acting nomination out of that was for Jennifer Jason Leigh, a white woman. Samuel Jackson gets totally shut out, even though, again, the movie was about his character. So there just seems to be a trend. I'm noticing a trend there.
Yeah, well, I was going to skip Hateful Eight anyway because, one, it got shitty reviews. And after Tarantino started talking all that shit about how Django Unchained and how it was just such an authentic movie about the slave experience, I was like, fuck and you, goodbye.
Quentin Tarantino is definitely that guy who took like one African American studies class 6 years ago and he thinks he just has it down pat. Knows everything. He's definitely that guy.
And he has black friends who don't check him on his shit, so.
I feel like he probably like brings up the fact that he's friends with Samuel Jackson in like every conversation. Like, I feel like, I never met Quentin Tarantino, but I could just easily see him talking about, and my friend Sam, I feel like he would do that like constantly if you talk to him.
Yeah. Well, look, we just have to revoke the Rizzo's card, so I can't fuck with respectability politics, especially from someone in Wu-Tang Clan. Like, how do you get there? How?
I know. It's like they spent well over a decade just completely shutting down respectability as a concept for young black men. And then it's like, huh? Where is this coming from? Well, the answer where it's coming from is probably money. I think once you become a millionaire, you get like a very skewed view of respectability and how that works. But I mean, it's just going back a little bit to the Oscars thing. It's like, it's very frustrating and difficult to be a person of color and trying to create things. And so I can't imagine how it is if you are a person of color who creates a story about a person of color and only the white people get respected and get recognition for it. I can't even imagine. That must be awful.
Yeah.
It's basically like me getting an award for sitting here and not speaking.
It's like you showed up and you weren't an asshole. Good job.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think, a gender aspect to this as well. Like, there's this great interview with Bjork where Bjork said, when it, in terms of, like, the reporting on her music, she said, even though she makes her own music, the nearest man in the room, if there's any man in the room while she's recording something or producing something, that man is instantly seen as, like, the director of the album or the lead producer of the album or a collaborator or something like that. And she said, it's not that she doesn't collaborate with men, it's that any men that are related in any way to her projects are just automatically seen as being, like, the inspiration or the lead producer or something like that. And it's this same type of, like, you know, like, ignoring or just believing that people of color or women of color can't be creators in their own right. They need help from whatever white guy is just, you know, around the block or something like that.
It's like, look, there's a white dude within 100 feet of this project. Surely this has something to
do with it. Co-creator must be the co-creator.
Well, I am an editor, so it is my job to help people do things. And I also happen to be white, so yeah, that's...
It's okay, we still like you.
It happens to the best of us, I'm sorry.
It is not my job to take credit for things, though, usually. Good.
True, very true. So, we actually got quite a few questions, because, as usual, our friend Tim, who was on this week's episode, seems to, like, have an endless font of questions, so we'll get to his four questions at the end. But our friend Apple Cider Mage had sent a question, and I don't know if she was being serious and wanted us to actually ask this, or she was just like, Sydney's awesome in saying this. But Apple Cider Mage asked, why is Sydney so right about everything?
Well, first of all, I want to give a shout out to Apple Cider Mage, because there is some serious smartness happening there. The Justice Points podcast, which unfortunately ended very recently, is excellent, and we're Twitter besties. So first of all, shout out and thumbs up to you. So why am I right about everything? Honestly, the less I use Twitter, the more right I am about things. So just sort of not being on Twitter, not that Twitter is bad, not that you can't use Twitter, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying when you sort of take a minute to step away, you really take the time to sort of, like, self-edit. I think one of the things I talked to Tanya about is it's like, before you hit tweet or before you hit send, you ask yourself, is now the time to say this? Should I be saying this? Is, you know, am I being an asshole? I think you ask yourself those questions more when you're not just on Twitter, sort of just, like, word vomiting all over the place. So I would say a good 60% of the time I'm right, and a good 40% of the time I probably just don't tweet. That's how I'm, like, able to seem to be right about everything. It's just, yeah, there's a thing happening that people are discussing. I don't think I have anything to add to it, so I'm just going to be quiet and listen and learn. So I think the more that people do that, I think we'll see a lot more rightness in the world. Just sort of be quiet, chill out, let people, you know, do their thing, read. Let me say that again. Read more. Everyone just needs to read more. Read more things by more people before you sort of jump in and tell us how you feel about everything. That's another important lesson.
Cool.
All right. Mighty Greg Dog asks, what pieces of media, parentheses, books, movies, TV, do you consider must read /see?
Right now I'm reading Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay. I highly recommend it just because it's so smart, it's so subversive, it's so honest. It makes you uncomfortable in all the right ways. It makes you very reflective. So definitely I would recommend Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay. Definitely, I think the past couple months there's been a real push for more women in sort of, like, I'll just call it nerd media, but, you know, like sci-fi and fantasy and, you know, be it video games or TV. So definitely I would recommend sort of like Penny Dreadful, Orphan Black, Mad Max, Fury Road. What else? Jessica Jones. These are all great shows with great women at the lead. I would definitely recommend looking at that. Issa Rae, I mentioned her earlier. I'm in love with her. Anything from her. She does Awkward Black Girl. She has a show called Insecure coming up. Again, I mean, like, I guess my answer is sort of, like, redundant, but anything with, like, women are people of color or women of color, that stuff, it's like, that's what I recommend. You know, like, get out of your little box. That's the space you should definitely get in to sort of, like, feed yourself and just get your brain going in these really great, interesting ways. That's definitely what I'm recommending. So any stuff I listed or just anything by people of color, do it. Okay. Go do it right now.
Cool. So Thane, Tim, is as usual, a font of questions. He is. He's adorable. We love him. So, if you were a Jedi, what kind of lightsaber would you have?
You know, I'm going to be totally honest with you, and I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about that before. I'm not even kidding. Before I even saw this question, I can honestly say that I have thought about that, just because Kylo Ren in the new movie has this sort of like burning cross monster sword. But then I also really like Samuel Jackson's lightsaber because it was purple and I really like the color purple. But then I also like dual wielding lightsabers where you like have two. Uh-huh. So I guess my answer would probably be if I could sort of combine that. So if I could have like a purple burning cross lightsaber that also I had two of them, that's the type of lightsaber I would have. Because it's ridiculous and implausible and unnecessary, and I think that fits my personality really well.
Okay, then.
I think the actual explanation for Kylo Ren's lightsaber is that the kyber crystal is cracked,
So
it doesn't make a steady beam.
Oh, I did not read that. That's interesting.
Yeah, that sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
That's interesting, because Kylo is so unstable. That actually is really cool.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
We thought that was so dumb when we first saw it.
Did you really?
True. Everyone did.
I thought it was cool. I'm sorry.
Well, some people are just like, the fuck? Like, what's wrong with his lightsaber?
I don't know. I thought it was cool. But I came around. I'll be honest with you. I'm a recent Star Wars nerd within like probably like 3 months as we were walking up. As we were getting ready for The Force Awakens, that's when I started watching Star Wars. So I'm like a novice to The Force. But that's what, like, the answer to the question. I was like, what kind of lightsabers I think is cool.
All right. And then the other question I will take is, what's one game, current or classic, that you feel no one should miss?
Okay, wow. Because I have to think about one game that is just, like, the most fun. And, you know, there's this huge conversation game critics are having about fun and how there's this real... It can be unnecessary to try to make a game fun. A game should primarily just be about the experience, about interactive experiences. Which I think is true, but if I think about one game that I just like had so much fun, it just really helped me out. It's definitely Yoshi's Island way back for the Super Nintendo. I remember 2 summers ago I played it. And I mean, when I say fun, I mean, just like, it's just a joyful game. And that's something that I don't think I can say about any game I've played this conversation or this generation, just in terms of like, Not funness. It's not so much about being fun. It's just a joyful, happy game. Like, I felt better. You know, I had more energy while I was playing it. I was very engaged with the colors and just how surreal it is. And just the part where, there's one part where Yoshi, if he touches a flower, the background starts melting. And, like, just, I had all these, like, sort of, like, silly, almost childlike reactions. And I don't know if it's just that, if it's just that I'm remembering how I felt as a child when I first played the game, but if I think about one game that just, in recent memory, that just made me happy, that just made my day better. I mean, that was the game that, when I played it, I felt like I was having a better day because I spent an hour or whatever playing that game. I would say Yoshi's Island. So I definitely think everyone needs to find their joy. Everyone needs to find their game that just makes them joyful for whatever reason. For me, it's Yoshi's Island. Whatever it is for other people, definitely go out and play that and definitely come back to it every now and then.
Cool.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It was like, it's a very, I don't know, that game is so silly and surreal and it doesn't take itself seriously. And there's this whole need to be this like gritty and dark and mature in lots of games nowadays. And there's none of that. Like, that's a game that's just there to make you a little bit happier.
Tim also asks, what is your favorite thing that you have read in the past year?
Favorite thing I've read in the past year, it's probably going to be Austin Walker's piece It was a dual piece about Watch Dogs and Shadows of Mordor, but then it was also about like race and gender and slavery. Because again, Austin Walker is brilliant. Everyone needs to follow him. He's great. But definitely like that piece that he wrote, just because it's something that when I first read that piece, I said to myself, if someone didn't know what video game criticism was and they didn't know that video games could be treated as these serious academic texts or something that you can engage with intellectually, this is the piece that I would send them, just because this is something that really I feel like was so smart and really elevated the text and really elevated how you play and perceive the game. I definitely thought that was something that like anyone with any type of like interest in examining culture could read that piece. I also want to give a shout out to Catherine Cross. Everything she writes is fantastic. She's done a lot of stuff for, I want to say feminist thing. I know she's done. I think she's done stuff for Femme Hype. She does a lot of stuff for Gamma Sutra. Definitely recommend you get out there and read stuff. And then also, I need just the I Need Diverse Games hashtag. I definitely think, in addition to sort of these sort of like weighty, you know, like heavier pieces, just listening to people, just see how people are reacting and what it is that people say that they want, you know, in their games. I definitely think that's also super, super necessary.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the last question Tim sent us is, who is your favorite outlet to write for?
So I'm going to sidestep that because I don't want anybody mad at me. I got to keep these checks coming in. I like everybody. But I will say this, to sort of alter that question a little bit, what makes an outlet good to write for? I definitely think to be, because I've had good and bad writing experiences, I think to be a good outlet that's worth writing for multiple times, fair pay, absolutely. An open dialogue between yourself and the editor, I think, is probably number one. I've written for places where the editor just did not clue me in on what the edits were. They did not get back to me. They ran the story without edits, and there were like errors and stuff in it, you know. So any of that, you definitely just stay away from those types of places. But any place that has like an open editor that's going to clue you into what the changes are, that asks you if you're okay with the changes, that's definitely going to be the place you need to write for. I know a lot of people want to write for quote unquote big places, and I can honestly say as a writer, that's not going to be your best bet. You need to write for a place where they respect you, respect your writing, and they want to clue you into the changes that they want to make to your work. So all that plus fair pay equals I would recommend writing for that place. And luckily Offworld, I will say, is one of the places that I would recommend, because they keep you clued in and fair pay.
Okay, cool. Yeah, Offworld is really good to me, and Lee, if you hear this, I know I still owe you a completed piece on Life is Strange, so please don't yell at me.
Yeah. Also, I would also recommend, if you want to write about games, there are lots of just like non-game site that do occasionally run pieces. So I would definitely recommend seeing through either their tech person or their culture person. Normally, tech, culture, and entertainment are going to be the verticals that run video game pieces. So I wrote an article for Salon. And they're not a video game site, but they were really interested in the piece I wrote about video games. And I pitched it to their entertainment editor. Same thing with Huffington Post or with The Guardian. A lot of these places aren't specifically video game sites, but if you've got a good idea that you feel like you can't quite get across at a gaming website, I would recommend these sort of like mainstream publications. But with those, you also have to be careful that your readers are going to be people who don't play video games. So just make sure that you're able to tailor your articles and your essays to that crowd. And I definitely check that out as well.
Very true. Because one thing I learned writing for Lee is that, you know, as much as I am a font of knowledge of all things Dragon Age, not everyone who read that piece was going to be. So I had to learn to generalize.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that you can read that a piece and then want to go play the game. Like I read your Offworld piece, and I felt like if I hadn't played Dragon Age, I'd been like, you know what? I want to. This is making me ask really good questions, so I'm gonna go in and play and sort of like see how I feel about it. We do not agree on this on the characters of Dragon Age, though. I still say Vivienne is a fantastic character, and Dorian is trash, and it's important that the people listening to this know that. At me if you disagree. I love talking about Dragon Age. I'm not even kidding. Like, if you have any Dragon Age feels, at me. We can work through them. We can talk about why your fave is trash and my fave is great.
Okay, that can be yeah. So maybe later in the year we can have a Dragon Age battle episode and David can referee.
Perfect. No, I'm going to get my wine and we can get into it.
Oh, and we have to get our friend Bianca on because she's like pro Vivian as well.
Well, because she chose the force. She chose the light side. Anyone who doesn't like Vivian is on the dark side.
Okay. Like, I don't care. It's like, because if we start talking about this, it'll be tomorrow. So we'll hold that conversation for the next time you're on the show.
The podcast is 7 hours long.
Oh God, no one, it'd be like everyone unfollows us.
Yeah. Just turn this on when you get to work and that's it.
Just let it go.
All day.
Yeah, maybe Sydney and I can do like a video podcast one day and just argue about Vivienne. That should be incredibly entertaining for everyone.
Well, the thing about Dragon Age is that their characters are just so intimate and complex, and you just really, really engage with them and see yourself in them, and you know, have a lot of feelings about them. I mean, if you go to Tumblr and type in any Dragon Age character, you're going to find lots and lots of fan arts. I mean, this is the Dragon Age series is a series that is so character driven that even the characters I don't like, I mean, like, I can definitely see what their appeal is, and I can definitely see why people are so passionate about them, just because it's like just a sprawlingly interesting character driven fantasy series. And I'm going to stop now because there's no way for me to talk about Dragon Age without getting all into my feelings. So I'm going to...
Okay.
I'm going to calm down.
That's okay. Just come in my Dragon Age stream the next time I play and we can have those feels.
Perfect.
But, you know, the last thing is we usually wind down kind of talking about what we've been playing, which you actually covered earlier with Over Battle 64, and I'll include a link to it because I've never actually heard of it. I'm still BioWare trash. I've actually been playing Dragon Age Inquisition again because I finally figured out how to mod the game on my PC, so I found all the mods, at least the ones that are not terrible, you know, change how a character behaves mods, because...
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Well, yeah, I found the straight Dorian mod, and I just... Nope.
The what?!
There's a mod to make Dorian straight or bi, so a female Inquisitor can romance him.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
That is a lot.
that was too fucking much. I just noped out of the Nexus for the rest of the day.
That is a lot.
Yeah, and I actually finished The Witcher 3 finally, but the DLC just, like, reached up, slapped me in the face, was like, nah, not today. You need to go back to a game you can handle, so... Me and the Hearts of Stone DLC need to have a come to Jesus moment, because that game is hard. Like, it was much harder than the core game. So one day, when I actually feel confident in myself, I will go back to Hearts of Stone DLC.
Yeah, I have the same problem with Witcher 3. Like, I beat it, then I went back to it, because for a while they were just giving out, like, free missions. And I remember just being just demolished by... It was like this like cave creature made out of crystals or something like that. Anyway, it literally just swatted me across the screen. And I was like, well, back to Dragon Age.
You're like, I tried. Oh, well.
I will say I was happy that DLC was free, because I would have been so frustrated if I paid money to get just stomped like that.
Yeah, it was an interesting 45 minutes that I streamed that DLC, and never again well, DLC times.
They started, because if you bought the vanilla game, it wasn't there, but a few months later, they got you New Game Plus. And I remember I started a New Game Plus file on a harder difficulty, because you get all your equipment and stuff, and again, it was just like, no, like, maybe I'm just not good at Witcher 3. Maybe that's what it is.
I don't know what it was, but it was just like... Well, you thought you knew how to play this game. Good luck with that.
Knock me back to Poland.
Well, you're black. You can't go back to Poland.
I can't be. Okay, keep that in the final version. All right, don't edit that out.
Oh, shit. All right, so, David, to finish us out for this first episode of 2016, what have you been playing recently?
I've been playing Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines and, like, tweeting about it at length. I don't know if you've seen any of those.
No, but I will go look once we've stopped recording.
Yeah, it is.
I'm curious.
It is one of those games where you have to, like, mod it a bit to, because it doesn't work on 64-bit operating systems unless you make significant changes.
Okay.
And I have a 64-bit operating system, so since I have to, like, mess with the program files anyway, I'm playing it with the companion mod, which has turned out to be, like, you play as a vampire, and, okay. With the companion mod, I seem to be, like, killgraving my way through the game.
Okay.
I think that's the only way I can describe it.
Okay.
Because, apparently vampires have mind control powers.
Okay.
I actually like mind control options in video games. Witcher 3 also has a, I can't remember the name, but it's like one of his crafts or whatever. Like, he's able to convince people with witchcraft, I think. Like, he, like, wiggles his fingers or something.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of his, like, magic spells in conversations.
Yeah. Other than that, I keep getting alerts on my phone from Star Wars Uprising because I sort of stopped playing it. And okay. The alerts are getting, like, increasingly desperate. It's like, we haven't seen you in a while. The galaxy is in shambles. What?
It's like, oh, well, I guess the galaxy has to be in shambles. Yeah, I turned off those alerts on my phone because I'm like, stop trying to guilt me into playing this damn game.
And you have to win battles that involve everyone to move the plot forward, so I'm never going to see the end of it.
yeah, just let that go. And with that, I last desperate plea from David's cell phone, I think we can call this episode a wrap. Sydney, where can people find you online?
I'm always on the Twitters. Definitely, I'm nice. I'm definitely nice. I'm always on the Twitters at soundfraud_son, or just Google Sydney Fussell or SydneyFussell.com. But yeah, if you want to talk to me, I talk back. Everything's fine. You can definitely at me there.
Cool. And then your website is SydneyFussell.com?
That's right.
All right. David, where can people find you?
I can be found on Twitter at Red Conversation, where you can see my vampire escapades, I suppose. I'm also on Twitch at Red_Conversation. My Patreon is patreon.com/redconversation. You should totally go to that and motivate me to, like, write things, because I need it. I need your money. let's see. I'm also on two other podcasts, one of which is Gosh Cartoons with Dave Rensing, Kiva Bay, and Verinder, who is on hiatus right now, I believe. And a new one that we're going to do, me and Kiva are going to do a podcast with Brother Dom.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're talking about it, and I think we're going to record, like, next week.
Awesome.
But I don't have, like, any details on that yet, but it exists, and you should look forward to it.
I shall. And I'm just Cypher tier everywhere except Hitbox, because I forgot I already had an account. And I think I'm, like, the real Cypher of Tear or something on there. But I never use Hitbox, so it doesn't make a difference. And actually, well, by the time this airs, the Spawn for Good version 2 for Reproductive Rights will be over. But you should still go follow our friends at Spawn of Me, because they're awesome. And they're doing great things for diversity in the gaming and podcast space. So that is spawnon.me, and they are on ESN, the Electric Shadow Network. And with that, we are done with our first episode of 2016. We will see you next week when we talk to Maxi Bytes. So have fun, play lots of games, and we will talk to you in a week.
Have a good whatever time of day it is for you.
Yes. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.